Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C. I'm going the distance. I'm going for speed. Folks, we've got a show for you today, and when I say we have a show for you today, I mean we have a show for you today. If you don't think we have a show for you today, then you are harboring a fallacy, and my respect for you has diminished. But before we talk about today's show, before we talk about today's guests, let me tell you a little bit about what's coming up and what has just come from Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts. If you've gone to the SunTrust website anytime recently, especially the store page, you might have noticed that the store page has been altered. And the reason for that is the debut poetry collection from Virginia Smith Rice, entitled When I Wake, It Will Be Forever, has just been released. Now, folks, I had the chance to check this one out before it went to print, and let me tell you something. If you can attach the title Page Turner to a volume of poetry, then this would be one of those, because once you start in on it, you just want to finish the whole book right in one sitting. Seriously, you just want to dive in and dive in deep on it. To get your copy, go to the Sundress web store at sundresspublications.com and look for the word store at the top of the page. Or if you can't find it, just hit Control F on your PC keyboard there and you'll find it eventually. But it's right there at the top, trust me. Then on Saturday, April 12th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the SAFTA home base at Firefly Farms in Knoxville, Tennessee, it is the third and final Outspoken Workshop. This time, the workshop is focused on turning edited work into a performance piece with the help of some great local Knoxvillean actors, dancers, and filmmakers. Now, we've never talked about the Outspoken Project on here, to the best of my knowledge, so let me bend your ear for a little second here about the Outspoken Project from Sundress. If you've never heard of it before, pay attention. If you have heard of it before, well, then pay attention. I gotta say, I think the Outspoken Project is an admirable effort from Sundress. It is a place and a chance and a project to create a platform for the LGBTQ experience and community of Knoxville and beyond to write and record and perform their experiences, to tell their stories, so to speak. But here's the deal, folks. If you are not in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, but you or someone you know has a story or an experience that they'd be willing to share about LGBTQ issues, whatever they may be, maybe they're a poet, maybe it's in prose, maybe they got a theater piece, maybe they started a short film about it, well, Outspoken wants to hear from you. You do not have to be local to the Knoxville area. If you go to the Sundress webpage, sundresspublications.com, and look for Submit at the top of the page, you can find all the details how you, no matter where you are in this country, in the 50 states or beyond, can contribute to this wonderful project. I encourage you to do this. And for more information about the Outspoken Workshop, if you are local or in the area of Knoxville, Tennessee, and you want to be a part of it, and the live shows that they will be doing throughout the summer of this year, they will be taking these performance pieces, not just editing them, but turning them into actual performance pieces and performing them, then I encourage you to check out the Facebook page for Outspoken. Do a little search for it, and you will find it. Trust me on this one. And you know, not only is the Outspoken Project a important project, I think, but it also provides an important segue, because the fiction judge for the Outspoken Project happens to be one and only Danny Huey Jr., who is our guest today on the program. I met Danny a couple of years ago, and I got to know him a little bit better last year when Flaming Gibbet, which is an imprint here at Sundress Publications, put out his book, which has since won a few awards, his first novel, The Butterfly Lady. And let me tell you, folks, just as a side note here, as a guy who reads quite a bit and read a lot of books of various genres last year, I gotta say that The Butterfly Lady was one of my favorites. I'm just saying, I'm going on record saying that. I enjoyed it. But let's talk about the guest here. Now, I said that Danny and I knew each other, but in a sense, we didn't really know each other until a couple weeks ago when he stopped by here at the SAFTAcast home base in South Florida, and we had a chat, and it was such a good chat that we just wanted to keep going. It was a really good time, the two of us chatting about things, getting to know one another, getting to know each other's various styles and idiosyncrasies or what have you. So good, in fact, that we decided to split it into two episodes. That's how good it was. Here on today's program, we deal with part one, which is a little more relaxed. We talk about some more kind of casual stuff and more, well, there's some interesting stuff. Don't worry. Don't freak out. It's not like we're just sitting there talking about superficial things. We talk about some deep stuff, too. But we have a great conversation, and then in part two, we talk about some of the heavier stuff of life and end up, I think, revealing a few things that we never intended to reveal on radio, but here we go. But before we get to part two, you gotta listen to part one, and that's upcoming in just about 33 seconds, because first we gotta have a taste of the theme song.
The reason I don't want him is if he starts meowing on mic and everything.
Oh, okay.
So I know what I'm doing. I kind of isolate myself here. Keep the aircons off and everything, so... So come on a little closer to the mic and everything. Don't be afraid. I mean, you can be a little bit intimate here. It's not like we're... you know, complete strangers to one another here.
Right, right.
So how you been?
Is it has started already? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm good.
Actually, we've been recording the last 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. If I feel like if I came in here and I just said, okay, here we go, or, you know, watch me hit the record button,
right,
then your demeanor changes. You're going to go,
I don't know
air.
Why I'm nervous. Like, I've done interviews before.
Do you want a cup of coffee? That'll make you more nervous.
No, actually, I don't like coffee. It's really odd, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I don't like
especially
coffee.
As a writer, you would think.
Yeah, I don't like, it doesn't keep me up, right? I remember I took a trip, me and my cousin went to, from Columbus to Atlanta, and we took those Modos.
Oh.
And it didn't do anything for me.
You still fell asleep.
Yeah, I still fell asleep. So after that, I was like, caffeine doesn't really do much for me, so I don't drink coffee.
It really doesn't do that much for me either. It wakes me in the morning, mm-hmm. gives me a jolt, but I can drink it all day, and I won't get really nervous or jittery. It depends. Sometimes a particular blend will do it. There's a blend I know called Organic Mexican that will drive me up a wall.
Wow.
But most of the time, it's just I do it for the flavor, for the social aspect of it.
Hmm. You know, I also think that my mom, I used to make coffee for her every morning.
Hmm.
So she drank Folgers.
Hmm.
So I would do that's a lie, Maxwell House.
Okay.
So two teaspoons of Maxwell House, a teaspoon of sugar every morning.
Mm.
So I think that kind of turned me off from coffee, too, because every single morning I had to make
coffee. Oh, okay. Just the routine of it?
Yeah, and I don't like the smell of it.
Mm, fair enough. Yeah. I'm sorry I'm sitting here with coffee. I'm drinking
it. Funny thing, I smelled it when I came into the house.
Of course.
I thought, he's making coffee. But how have I been? I've been good. It's been, this has been a very interesting year.
And we're only 2 months in.
Right. So I guess last year and this year, you know, end of 2013, beginning of 2014, so it's been good so far.
You've had massive success over the last couple of years, it seems like.
Yeah.
Following you.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like you came out of nowhere suddenly.
Well, I think that's interesting, right? Because a lot of times I feel like, oh, is anybody going to know who I am? You know, am I going to... And I don't know if I want to be famous, right? I had these reoccurring nightmares of fame, right? Am I going to be famous, or do I just want people to just read me and know
your name,
right?
You know, and kind of just leave you alone, you know,
right.
Send you messages like, oh, you know, thanks for the book, it was really good,
right?
But then, you know, not running after you at the hotel,
right? Right. But then some part of me says, and this is I'm revealing it. It's like some part of me said, oh, I do want to be famous.
how many writers, though, can we name that actually have people clamoring after them at the hotels?
I mean, yeah.
I can't think of any.
Right. I mean, so sometimes I think, I want to be famous, but then I realize what comes with that, right? Do I really want to? Yeah, so.
I thought that way, too. When I was starting out, I wanted to be in film.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do Hollywood. I wanted to do television. I wanted to do movies. But then I learned the business side of it all, and I learned the dark sides,
mm-hmm.
and I have abandoned all that. Now, I love watching movies. I love good television. I would never want to be in that world.
Mm-hmm.
I would hate it.
Well, at one point, I wanted to own my own press.
Mm.
So I had a name for it and everything.
What was going to be the name?
Behind the Green Door Publishing. Like, it's something about it's Behind the Green Door, right?
It's a porno title, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, no, I didn't know, Scott.
Yeah. No, Behind the Green Door, yeah.
It's a porno?
Yeah, it's a porno, I believe. I have to look it up and check.
Well, yeah, I wanted to own the press. I wanted to publish stuff and edit. I like editing. I really enjoy editing.
Mm-hmm. Editing just fiction or just poetry or whatever?
Well, the funny thing is, I don't think I've ever told you this.
No.
I have told Tiff this, but I used to, I'm a failed poet.
Mm. No, I did not know that.
I was going to be a poet. In my mind, I was
going
to be a poet. So I tell my students this story all the time in class when we talk about poetry. When I was in undergrad, I was a poet. I wrote all these, they were really bad poems. Like I say that now, right? Because I studied poetry. But back then, I thought I was a poet.
Yeah.
Never thought I'd be a fiction writer. So I had a mentor in college, Dr. Roberts, and I said, yeah, I wrote all these poems. I don't know if you can look at them. He was a folklorist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they had to do with poetry, but, you know.
Yeah.
So I gave him a folder of, like 50 poems.
Typical undergrad move.
And I was, you know, I was a little cocky undergrad. And so a couple weeks later, I was sitting there. I was like, Dr. Roberts, what do you think about my poems? He was like, well, yeah. He said, you're not a poet. I said, I am a poet. So we argue, like, I literally argue with this tenured professor.
Defensive, yep.
And he said, and then he leaned across the table. He said, you're a fiction writer. I said, what do you mean? I said, I don't write fiction. He said, and he put out this story. I had started this story, and I didn't even know it was in there with the poetry. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this is what you should do. And so for a very long time, I was hurt because I was I thought, no, I'm really a poet. Mm-hmm. But then when I really started to go back and think about, well, maybe, let me go back and look at this story. Mm. And that's when I really started to think, oh, maybe I'm not a poet. But I want to be a poet. All of my friends are poets.
do you still write poetry? Do you try your hand at it now that you have more knowledge of the genre and everything?
I think I do, right? When in graduate school, we have to take a workshop, right? Yeah. So I've taken several poetry workshops. Mm-hmm. So I've learned how to write poems structurally, right? I know how to do that. But I still think that, even though I don't think that they're that good, even though I think that some people would say that, you know, they may be good, but in my mind, I don't think that I just don't think I have the talent for it, honestly.
I don't know if it's talent. I mean, some people have technical skill. Mm-hmm. Right? Jimmy Carter's poetry, President Jimmy Carter, his book of poetry, technically it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Structurally, you know, it's textbook, but the passion isn't there. And I think you need the passion and technical skills to really make it work. You need a combination of both.
And I always wonder, can you teach somebody how to be a poet?
I think you can to a degree. Mm-hmm. You can teach them the tricks. Like, when I talk to undergrads about poetry, they hate the unit. That's the one they fear the most.
Yes, it is.
And I break it down for them. I say, here's why. You were taught wrong about poetry. They were taught lines, stanza, meter, and rhythm.
Right.
They were given what I call the elephant graveyard, old dead white dudes.
Right, right.
Edgar Allan Poe, Robert Frost, and in the words of my mentor, Dr. Angela Ball, Frost can be annoying sometimes.
Right.
He can be. Poe, I'm not a big fan of his poetry. His fiction, wonderful.
Wonderful.
Nonfiction, his criticism is great, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, he's one of the first to actually figure out, if I get in the weird realm of science, he's one of the first to figure out why the sky is dark at night.
Mm.
He's one of the first to figure it out and blows everyone's mind in science. You go, wait, what the hell? This scrawny weirdo just figured it out for us? He didn't get it exactly right, obviously, but it would be proven years later that he was on the right path. And you can look it up. But, no, my students have problems with it, and I show them that that's what they were taught. What they don't understand are the real aspects, sonics, the sound of words, rhythms of words and language, mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry mutates so fast
and
for so many different people. But I think you've got to have passion and skill. I think you can teach certain things, but if the heart isn't there, so to speak, it ain't going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, in the words of Willie Nelson, you can't play a song if you don't know nothing to play.
Oh, yeah. Country music is beautiful. I was playing country music in class the other day, and I was like, you listen to country music? I was like, I love music. I listen to all types of music.
Wait, okay, so country music. When we're talking about country then, okay, because I grew up on good country.
Mm-hmm.
Such as who? Who in your world is good in your eyes in country?
Well, of course I love Dolly Parton. I know.
no argument there, okay?
I think Dolly Parton writes some of the best dang on songs. It is so simple. The lyrics are simple, but you feel the pain. You feel the beauty in the pain, right? So for me, Dolly Parton, I like Willie Nelson, right? Like I listen to a lot of Reba McEntire.
Oh, Reba.
Love Reba McEntire. I just love her. She just keeps She becomes a different person every decade, right?
Mm-hmm. But not like Madonna. She keeps it within a certain range of things, but shifts it just a little bit on you.
Well, see, Madonna, we're going to take a quick shift, right? What I loved about Madonna, like when Madonna first came out, right? I really loved that Papa Don't Preach album, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Madonna is about shock, right? I think she's so old now that she can't shock me anymore.
She tries,
but it's just like,
It's like Marilyn Manson trying to shock you now, and you're like, we're past that.
We're past
over.
That, right. But I like Lady Antebellum, but I don't like their name. But I do like Lady Antebellum.
Fair enough.
And I, what is the Dixie Chicks? I actually really like the Dixie Chicks.
Nothing wrong with that. They're a pretty potent band.
Mm-hmm. It's a shame how their career went down in tubes after that. True. However, I think that they're really... So I really like... What I love about country music is just the lyrics. Like they really pay attention to the construction of a song, right?
You find some great storytellers mm-hmm. in country. Tom T. Hall, for example, is mm-hmm. one of the best songwriters, storytellers, I should say, because song-wise, you look at the structure, he won't have bridges and choruses. It'll be one verse, very folk song style. Right. But he's a hell of a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. One of my favorites of his is Ballad of $40, which is about a guy who died. And it's from the point of the view of the people burying him, the gravediggers.
Oh, wow.
And at the end of it, they're just like, you know, I hope he rests in peace. Problem is, the guy owes us $40. And that's the way it ends. It's just, you know, they're just commenting on the funeral, and it just ends with them realizing, you know, I hope he rests in peace. Problem is, the fella owes us $40. Damn. It's just a great, charming song. Or The Man Who Shot Himself is one of the most heartbreaking songs. Because it deals with suicide, obviously, but it deals with it unlike many other songs in that the story in that song is there's no reason for him to kill himself. It's just a description of this guy's life, and there's nothing odd or unusual or frightening. You know, his favorite music was country. He put his faith in Jesus. He paid his taxes. He drank beer every now and then. He was good to people. And one day he just goes home and shoots himself.
Yeah.
And you sit there at the end, left with the question of why did he do it? And that's exactly what he wanted you to do, is make you question, what was the point? Why did he do it? So I think, you mentioned Dixie Chicks, I'm thinking immediately Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
His voice is finally starting to go, though. I saw him in a couple, his last album, starting to wither.
He's, what, 100, though?
He's up there.
He's up there, right?
He's up there. I mean, he, you know, but... I've said in the past that Chris wrote one song. You don't even need the music or the lyrics. Just the title will tell you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one song. Everything, Loving Her was easier than anything I'll ever do again.
Mm.
You don't need anything more. Just the title tells you everything you need to know. So, okay, so you're kind of mixed in country. Some new stuff, some old stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think growing up, in the 70s, right, 80s, my family's from the South. My mother's from Memphis. My father's from he's from California. He's from California. And so my family grew up next to Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this, you know, country rock influence type of thing. And so we listened to a lot of music growing up. And a lot of my family is very musical. They sing. A lot of my family is very artistic, right? They're one of my cousins, he writes plays. I have some singers, like black people like singers. We got some singers in our family. Like, we have some people that really are very, very musical. And even when I was in church, you know, I sang in a church choir. We all, you know.
You still sing? I mean, can I take you out to karaoke sometime?
You know, the funny thing is, I'll go, but the funny thing is, I don't like a lot of attention. Like, okay. The funny thing is, I want to just do what I need to do, but I don't want a lot of people in my face.
But you don't want to be invisible at the same time.
I don't want to be invisible, but I think. It's odd, right?
Again, you don't want the spotlight.
I don't want the spotlight, but so I'll do stuff. Like I'm an introvert. I'm very much an introvert.
Okay.
But I live in an extrovert world, right?
So sure. Same here.
But I would really prefer to just sit at home and watch TV or write.
Fair enough. But you don't want to be invisible in the world of it.
But
all,
I think that my writing is what's going to keep me visible. Right.
So it's like you want the writing to speak for itself, then,
right.
Not the author.
Right.
So this is a weird situation. Then
it's odd for me. Like to be honest with you, on the way over here, I was like, oh my god, I'm actually about to be on the. When I got interviewed for the forward review thing, I was so nervous. Like even with the Lambda stuff, because I was thinking, you're on display, right? You're on display, but then why do you write, right? So it's like I'm like a. A human walking contradiction.
No, that's cool. Here, you know, just chill, man. It's not about your writing here.
Well, I know, but it's still about, like, I'm a very political person, right?
Yeah.
So people, if you don't know me, right, you don't know those things, right? I'm very, very, very political, very, you know, passionate about politics. House of Cards is like the best. Have you watched it?
I have not watched it yet.
Oh, Scott.
I haven't gotten into it yet.
You got to watch it.
All right. I'll put it in my queue.
I promise you, you will be hooked. Like, first season, I watched it for 2 days straight.
Mm-hmm.
Season two, it came out on Valentine's Day. I'm already done.
Hmm.
Like, it really...
Binge watching.
Yeah, and I'm going to go back and watch it again, right? Because I think that what it does is really get at the heart of what's happening in Washington right now. This is what politicians are like. They're like snakes, right? And they maneuver and they manipulate. And it's like the humanity really... Because I used to always think, oh, when people go into politics, they don't lose their humanity. I think they do, right? Mm. I think they lose it. I think
you lose your soul, basically.
Right, and I think they have good intentions. I think they all go in with good intentions, right? But then they leave. When they leave, they're like these shells of their former selves, right?
It's something about the system that crushes them.
And they're ruthless.
Mm.
They're ruthless. And it's just to see, you know, how power shifts and the balance of power and, you know, if you do this, I'll do that. It's just really interesting to watch those dynamics. So even though I'm not a big Scandal fan, and all my friends are like, how do you not like Scandal? Yeah. That's a whole other conversation. But just to actually watch that show unfold, it's amazing.
I haven't watched it yet. I'm not big on the Netflix original yet. I watched a few episodes of Orange is the New Black over Christmas, and I liked what I saw, but when I came back from break, I didn't stick with it,
right?
Because I got distracted by the rest of my queue, which is all these different things. And it's like, oh wow, now you know I can watch this, or you know, it's all these fascinating. So my Netflix queue is the most eclectic thing of like recently watched stuff.
Wow,
it's like, okay, here's Futurama. Now we got Quantum Leap. Okay, those are both science fiction, and then here's the history of the WWE next to a 6-part series on the BBC about Auschwitz.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's like, I don't know. I just got intrigued, and suddenly I'm hooked on it. So I will put House of Cards on my list to check it. Because I do like Kevin Spacey overall.
Yeah. You know? He's brilliant.
That's what I've heard.
He's brilliant. But you know who's also really? Robin Wright.
Oh, from The Princess Bride, you know, that's where she's introduced. Yeah. So
she is, man, because it's based off of a BBC thing. And so I was doing some research, and the BBC thing is the wife is actually, like, the man, Francis is the person who pushes everything. The wife is the one who puts it in his ear. You need to do these things.
It's Macbeth almost.
Huh? It is Macbeth. I told my friend this morning, I said, it is Macbeth all over again. It's a Macbeth of 2014. Because she tells him, this is what you need to do. And she has orchestrated this whole move from one part of to Congress to vice president to whatever happens next. She is orchestrated. And she's so cool and calm and cold. And it's just brilliant.
A good character. Great character.
I love watching her. I'm like, she is interesting.
Yeah. She faded from the spotlight for a while, though. Like, Princess Bride, then she had... disappears for a bit.
She was gone for a long time.
Yeah, and then suddenly to hear her, I was like, I saw the name, and I'm like, is that?
But she was in some other stuff, though, right?
She was, I think. I'd have to pull up her bio on the IMDb.
Princess Bride was like the 80s, right?
Yeah, that's 87 or so. And she vanishes for a bit. And then
she got married to, you know, Penn.
Yeah. I don't know.
She was in some other stuff.
I want to say she was. She had to be. But she wasn't in main... She wasn't, like... mainstream focus for a while. But then you have a lot of artists like that who do that. Hollywood, I think, is one of the few places that actually you can do that. You can disappear for a while and then come back. You can't do it in music.
No, you cannot.
Very few can pull it off.
Madonna.
Yeah, unless you're already established as like upper echelon of superstardom.
Prince disappears for long periods of time and just shows back up, right? But if you're as beautiful as Prince, you can do those things, right?
Fair enough.
I mean, it's Prince. Right? Fair enough. And he has all this music, and he'll say, oh, I'm going to drop an album, and he may not drop an album.
And then when he does, you're not expecting him to drop the album. And then when he does, you're like, where did you go? Did you ever go anywhere?
Right. It's like it's almost like he's timeless. Right?
His last single, Breakfast Can Wait, I listened to that, I was like, if this was anybody but Prince, I would probably be, you know, seeing this as a novelty internet track where we all giggle and go, ha, ha, ha. But it's Prince, so you kind of shut up and go, I don't care how weird or goofy this is, it's Prince.
Because Prince is an artist.
I love the Prince. One of my philosophies in life is no night is truly complete without a Prince song. Think of it. Your best nights that you've ever had, At some point you heard Prince. Whether you knew it or not, you heard, you know, a snippet of Purple Rain on the radio station or whatever. And I swear,
when doves cry, yeah.
I will not.
I was listening. This felt crazy because you're right. On the other day, when Doves Cry was on the radio, and I was like, I was having a great day.
It does. It's something about it. There's something about Prince's magic that just comes out of nowhere. His performance at the Hall of Fame when he got inducted, was mind blowing.
I've never seen Prince at concert.
Neither have I.
I have a friend who I was talking to this morning. Mm. She goes to every Prince. No matter what's going on, she's going to see Prince. Other friend who lives in L.A., he goes to see Prince back to back. He said, I saw him last week. I'm about to drive up to Las Vegas to see him again. It's Prince.
He puts on a hell of a show.
Yeah.
You go to it, you're going to a show. You're not going to just a concert. You're going to a show. Mm. And it's going to be good because we know he can play. Mm-hmm. We know he can sing. We know, he's a little bit loony in some ways. But I see him as more of like not Michael Jackson weird. He went that way for a bit, but then he came back.
I always think about this. Like, when we talk about being weird, right? Mm. As artists, aren't we all kind of weird, though?
Show me a writer who's sane, and I'll show you the most boring shit you'll ever read.
Right. So, it's funny because I talk about writers who've, like, committed suicide or who've, like, you know, drank themselves to death. I wonder, damn it, is that going to be me? That's something I think about, that, right? Mm. Like, what is the thing that stops me from going over, right?
Cause I think good point.
When I'm in that space and the stuff that I'm working on, right, it's some deep stuff, right?
Some dark territory you go into.
Right. So sometimes I do have to just stop.
I totally understand.
And I wonder, like, what is it? Like, I love Sylvia Plath, right? And I always wonder, what was the final thing that took her over?
Ted Hughes.
Well,
you could make that argument. You make that argument. Over, but hard to tell.
We'll never know. And Virginia Woolf, right? She just stuffed rocks into her pocket and just walked into the
Maybe David Foster Wallace, we might be able to understand.
What happened with him, though? Like,
They took him off antidepressants and they didn't wean him. Hmm. So they kind of just took him off cold turkey, and that was a major factor. Because he was severely, severely depressed. He had massive depressive problems. And he was on very powerful antidepressants. And they thought, oh, you're doing good right now. Let's take you off. And they basically took him cold turkey.
But he was doing well because of the depressants, though, right?
He was, but he also was... He did not like fame. He
did not, yeah.
If you ever see interviews with him, he's got a bandana on most of the time. The reason is nervous sweating. He would sweat incessantly if he was being interviewed or anything. So he wore the bandana to control that, to kind of just mop it. So he had his issues, but it's a little more understandable why he did that. Some have argued that he did it for fame, actually. He killed himself for fame.
Really?
There have been that criticism, but I don't know how well that holds up.
So one would kill themselves for notoriety so that we remember...
To be remembered, you know, and how many artists get popular after death? Yeah. So why not? You know?
But don't you want to be... Well, if you didn't like... So here we go. If you didn't like the fame... Yeah, that's interesting.
I don't know. I've read criticism of that he did that, but it's hard to tell. I mean, we'll never truly understand. Right.
Did he even know?
No, not that I remember.
He shot himself, right?
Hung himself. Hunter S. Thompson shot himself and left a note, and his note simply said, it was a short note, and then at the end of it just said, football season is over. And that was his statement. Is that pretty much, I've done everything, it's over. And so he shot himself then. Again, we don't understand, though. I mean, I don't think we ever will. Suicide's the toughest form of death, I think, to understand in many ways for those who are left behind, because most of us, I would say, don't have that drive
right.
to truly destroy ourselves outright. I mean, there's the subtle death, smoking, drinking, the desire to return to the unknown, the Thanatos concept. But not all of us go, I'm just going to let go of the steering wheel and hit the median. I don't care. Most of us don't have that urge.
Right.
We have that switch in our brain that says, don't do that.
Right.
You know, whether that's evolution or just social psychology, I don't know. But that's a good question. Like, what push, you know, will you become that person? Because I know many writers who don't go that route, and many artists who don't go that route, but are self-destructive.
Yeah, very much so, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do things, some do things.
And we're not talking 18 years old when you're like, I'm going to jump off the roof just because my body can handle it.
Right.
Woo!
Right.
But 30, 40 years old, and they're drinking heavily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or they're smoking, like, you know. There we go, there's the cough. You know. We destroy ourselves, but... Yeah. Dark territory. We're on dark territory.
Yeah.
I mean, do you deal with that a lot in your writing, this dark territory?
Yes. I think that, The Butterfly Lady was a very, very hard book to write.
It does deal with some dark stuff.
And I had to go back to some places that I didn't want to go back to, right? And so and it's funny because a lot of my friends, they read my dissertation. It's like, do you write anything that's not sad? I was like, I don't know, but I don't want to romanticize black life, right? I want to write
realistic.
What's going on for real, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I did write this funny story on the watermelon eating contest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really funny. It was still kind of, you know, I had its
dark moments,
but it was hilarious. So I was thinking, I could do this.
So it's kind of black humor that is in, like, tone dark.
Right.
You know, black
so I was
humor.
Thinking, I could probably do this. But when I start working on the next book, so my grandmother was schizophrenic.
Okay.
And she was on medication. She was on meds. But then she stopped taking them.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, for the rest of her life, she battled with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know.
Like, she kept it hidden?
Well, the grandkids, right? We didn't know.
Oh, the little
right.
ones.
But my family knew, but they didn't really talk about it. So
subject.
When she died, when my grandmother died, my aunt found this letter that she had written. And she talked about how these people were always following her.
Mm. Right?
And how she was trying to protect her kids and how was she going to protect her family if these people kept following her. And it really broke my heart because she suffered in silence, right? And I always wanted to know, this is how projects start for me, like I always want to know, why do people do what they do, right? Why are you suffering in silence? What is it about your environment, the people around you? Why are you suffering in silence? So the book I'm working on now it does talk about schizophrenia in a way that I've always wanted to write about it, right? This duality, right?
So you're doing probably a lot of research then, I'm
assuming. You know what, Scott? I love research for academic purposes.
But when it comes to creative, hell no.
But the thing is, I want to get... Like, if I'm doing stuff in Cleveland, I want to make sure that I have my streets correct, right?
Fair enough, yeah.
But for the most part, I try not to... Because it can get... I can do research, but sometimes it becomes stale, and sometimes it kind of takes over the work.
Sometimes you just have to shut the fuck up and write.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's it right now.
No, I know what you mean, exactly. Sometimes, I'm working on a book of love, of what I call love poems to pop music. Because it's my life.
Right.
And I'll pull up the footage. I'll think, I'm working on this one poem. I'll pull up the footage on YouTube, or I'll listen to the song over and over, and I'm stuck. I can't write the thing. And I hear my editor, who's also my wife, say in my head, and she was the one who first said to me, shut the fuck up and write.
Mm-hmm.
We can fix everything in editing.
And that's it. That is so
true. So you just got to shut up and go, who cares? Let's just write about this. What do I think?
And the thing is, because I love knowledge, I love learning things, I can spend days just reading research. But like you said, actually writing.
Yeah.
And you're right, you can go back and fix stuff. But if you don't get it out, right?
What's the point then? So, all about production.
Right. So I just, you know, I just have to, so I do, when I'm setting stuff in certain places, I want to be historically accurate in terms of location and street name.
You don't want somebody to call you up and be like, excuse me, you got your street wrong.
Right, because my friends, right, they were like, hey, oh my God, those are the streets that we grew up on. I was like, I know, right? This is where we played. This is where
so you grew up in Cleveland?
Oh, yeah. Grew up in Cleveland, born and raised in Cleveland, grew up in the projects, and then we moved to St. Clair. We lived a lot of different places. We moved a lot.
Because you said your mother was from Memphis, father's from California, and you're in Cleveland.
Well, that's where they met.
Okay.
That's where they met, because my father moved to Cleveland. My mother moved to Cleveland when she was 16. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. She moved when she was 16. She met my father. They got married. She had my sister at 17. She had me at 18. She was married. She was married. And then she had my brother at 21. She was a very young mother.
Four kids by the time 21.
Three. Three kids.
That's intense.
And my father was, my father is maybe 5 years older than my mother. So technically, they probably should have been together. But. So technically, right? Mm-hmm. So they met, and because all of my family had migrated. That's also, I'm also fascinated by migration, right?
Like, yeah.
What does it look like? Why do you do it? Because you go from the racist South, mm-hmm. right, to still the racist North, but it's really very different type levels of racism.
Yeah,
right? Because I remember my mother telling me, she's born in 55. So she grew up during the civil rights era,
right,
when that was happening,
when there's chaos,
right, and just to have those conversations has always been very interesting in my family, because again, my family also, they tell a lot of stories too, which is very interesting, right? And the comedians, like, it's funny, you have people singing, telling stories, and laughing. Always a lot of laughter in my house, like, we laugh all the time.
Family reunions got to be awesome.
Loud. Like, it's so loud. When they were here in Florida, it was like 5 of us. We were loud. It was just so amazing. It was loud. So that was very interesting for them to do that, and for her to move here at such a young age. And everybody started moving from Memphis to Cleveland. And that's where we've been. So most of my family is still there.
So you went from Cleveland then off to Texas.
No. I went to Ohio State.
First the Ohio State University.
And then I moved back to Cleveland. I was a teacher for a minute. I was a health teacher. I taught.
I did not know that about you.
I taught health education. I taught at the Health Museum of Cleveland.
Huh.
And I taught about sex ed. I taught about, reproductive. I taught everything. It was funny, right? And then I was like, because for a while I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I never thought I'd be a teacher, to be honest with you. And so teaching in the health, I was like, oh, okay. I just didn't like the little kids. I didn't like them grabbing on my legs. And so didn't like that. So I was like,
I'm trying to teach sex ed to like a 5-year-old or something. Because you're saying it's clever.
So it would range from like the elementary school kids. So the elementary school kids, we talked about having a baby, reproductive, right?
But yeah.
It was very much tailored to
Very young, like very young mommies people. Have babies.
Yes.
You know?
And we had this room where you see the different stages, and then there's actually a birth, so you actually walk. So it was very fascinating.
It was not very nothing too graphic either.
But like 94,
yeah,
I graduated about 93.
94, yeah,
it was very
94. That's pretty progressive.
It was, right.
It is.
And so then to do that, and then to go into the high schools and talk about sex education, and because people really weren't really talking about STDs a lot. I mean, even though it was still. A major thing.
It wasn't until MTV in the mid-90s
right.
started putting on the condom commercials
right.
and actively saying, listen, this AIDS thing ain't going away.
Exactly. And so to talk about that, like in 93, 94, it was like, what?
Yeah, because my sex ed, I think in like 7th grade, was basically they split us into two rooms, and I don't remember anything of it. Other than maybe, like, boys have a, going back to kindergarten cop, boys have a penis, girls have a vagina, the end.
Right.
And everything else I learned from magazines and everything, and then found out later on, wait, none of this makes sense, none of it's real.
Right.
This is fantasy, so none of it actually works in real life.
Right.
And they don't, it's just my issues with it all.
So I was at the health museum.
I
want to just travel, so I quit my job, and I moved to New Jersey. And I worked at the Wawa.
I was a manager in training at the Wawa's. I love Wawa's. When I go to Orlando, I see the Wawa's. I get really excited. I love Wawa's, making sandwiches. It was the best. It was like, really, I was 23 and just hanging out. And I moved to New Jersey.
Where in New Jersey? Where were you?
I was in East. I was in Cherry Hill, which is close to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Right across the bridge. So me and my cousin go back and forth to Philadelphia, have friends in New York. So I did that. And then I moved back to Columbus, and I was taking classes. And then I was like, oh, let me get a master's degree. You're like, you know, what are you doing?
What else, you know?
And then I moved to upstate New York, to SUNY Albany, got a master's degree there. And I was like, oh, let me get another master's degree. Now, clearly, I didn't need all these master's degrees.
No.
But I wanted to get an MFA. But I was afraid that I wouldn't get into an MFA program.
Okay.
Because I was still new.
Yeah.
I was still new in the craft. And I didn't really understand. I don't think I really knew how to be a writer until I really sat down and wrote, right?
Right.
But, so I was afraid that I wouldn't get in. So I applied to a master's program that had a concentration in creative writing.
Okay.
Which is what I did. And then I was like, oh, okay, I think I'm okay. And so I almost went to NYU to get my MFA after that. But I was like, that would be 3 master's degrees. I was like, no.
That's so, overkill.
Yeah, I thought it was too much. And so my advisor, my thesis advisor, was like, no, I really think you should get this MFA. He said, I think that you're ready, blah, blah, blah. And the thing is, Scott, people, I don't know. No, you don't know this.
No, I don't.
I'm actually harder on my, I'm hard on myself.
Mm-hmm.
So the talent that people may see, I necessarily don't see all the time.
Mm.
So even though it's very rare that I write something, I'm thinking, oh, this is really good. Very rare.
You're preaching to the choir on this one, Danny. Right. You're preaching to the choir. It drives my wife, it drives my friends nuts.
Oh, my God.
Because they're like, you don't publish nearly enough. And I'm like, no, because it's not ready yet.
Yeah, I think that
it's not ready.
I think you need to send more stuff out, too. And, but, you know.
Yeah, it's like...
But so it's interesting, like he sat down and talked to me. He was like, this is a beautiful thesis. He said, you're a writer. He said, this is what you're supposed to do. And I was like, yeah. So I got the PhD because I was afraid to be a writer.
Mm.
I've never said that out loud. Oh my God.
Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Saftcast.
Yeah, I was afraid to be a writer. And I figured I get
this. What were you afraid of?
I was afraid that there's an expectation, right? That if you do, so this is what happened in the master program, right? I would write a story, being very, I always wanted to play with structure and style, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I write a story, and it would be a good response to it.
Okay.
And then I had to think, and I'll be so nervous for the next assignment because I'll think, oh my God, I have to produce again.
Hmm.
So it's this fear, right? This fear of, if it's really good, can I do it again?
Yeah.
So I think that's why when I'm writing, I really push these boundaries because I feel like, can I do it again? Right? So there's something competitive about that, but it's also something that really, the weight of it just really weighs me down a lot of time. So
it can be a hard stress to deal with.
Yeah. So it took me 6 years to actually finish the book.
Hmm.
And I almost didn't finish it. Because I got scared. I was like, oh my God, like, it's almost done. What do you do next?
Yeah.
And one of my really good friends, L. Lamar Wilson, I said, oh my God, I said, yeah. And he had a portrait collection out. He's like, Danny, we're only good as our next book, that it has the next thing.
Hmm.
I'm like, oh God. So, yeah, I was in the, even though it was a PCU, you know, with creative writing emphasis, right? It still felt safe.
Yeah.
Because it was mainly a lit degree, right?
Yeah.
With a couple of creative writing classes, so I spent more time doing
the... you can stay in the womb. You don't have to leave into the real world yet.
Right. But then it was inside of me, it was like, but Danny, you really want to be a fiction writer. So why aren't you doing these things? So my PhD advisor, like my chair, we used to have these long conversations about, why don't you know that you're good? I was just like,
ah. You're forgetting, you're preaching to the choir here. My wife saw me like that too. And she knows. She's like, you're good.
Yes, you are.
Why aren't you hearing that? Why can't you see that what I see in that.
But don't we all do, as artists? I see. I'm always thinking about this artistry, right? What does it really mean to be an artist?
Yeah.
And I think more and more now, right, that the book is out, and I'm looking at, you know, what is it I want to continue to do in my career, mm-hmm. right? Like, what? There's those insecurities that artists have, right?
Yeah.
We don't really talk about it, I think.
I think you're right. Like, some of the people I know, they seem to just pump it out effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, I know some writers very intimately, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them, and they seem to pump out the work, and it's almost perfect the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some, though, that will actually edit and everything, but I don't see the insecurities in them. They must have them, but if they do, they damn sure keep them hidden from me.
And so I think, as human beings, right, I think that if we are given the space to express those insecurities, that will be, I think, mentally and emotionally, will be a lot better.
Hmm.
So I think, for me, what I have done, right, and I think since my mother's death, right, my whole perspective is, I've always been an open person, right, in terms of my friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a person who would say, okay, this is how I feel. I think now it's even more important to say, I'm struggling today, and this is how, right? Or, I'm really feeling insecure about my writing right now,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I used to hold all that stuff in, and it would just weigh me down.
Mm.
And so I think that the same thing with mental health, right? Because, again, this stuff is in my family. I think that when we're silent about these things, right, it eats away at us slowly.
It right? does. And then if you... The problem with social media, I think, is that if you do say things like that, like, I'm feeling insecure about my writing. If you write that as a status update on Facebook, mm. you're going to get flooded with people going, no, your writing's good.
Right.
And while they mean it maybe from a genuine place... When you're in that mental state, you mm-hmm. see it as being insincere, patronizing, right. or others, or if somebody sees it as you're pandering, you know, you're,
right.
you're
trying doing to this. Get, yes,
and
yes.
there's a problem that because maybe you are coming from a genuine place mm-hmm. and you're looking for someone to basically give you a call and be like, listen, yes, your writing is good, but it's okay to feel insecure right now.
Right.
And you don't get that, I think, from social media, unfortunately. That's why I don't, on Facebook and everything, I don't talk about those things.
Yeah.
Because I'm afraid of people looking at me and going, you're doing this for attention.
Right.
Or, you know, here's, you know, let's give you some platitudes, and I'm going to worry that I'm going to look at them as insincere.
Right.
Because I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for someone to give me a call, basically, and be like, all right, let's chat.
Yeah.
You know, ask yourself, what is really going on here?
Right.
What's the real issue? It's not that you're insecure about your writing. There's something deeper that you're wrestling with right now.